Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's the weekly program that looks at science and technology in our everyday lives. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. I'm here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, one thing you may never have pondered is the intelligence of a lizard. Well, as it turns out, maybe you should have, because guess what? Humans don't have the corner on intelligence. It turns out that reptiles are more intelligent than anyone ever knew. And we'll speak with Gordon Burghardt. Now, strangely enough, he's a comparative psychologist at the University of Tennessee. And I say strangely enough because he's not actually a herpetologist or one who studies reptiles. Stay tuned for that conversation up next.
And Lynn, I look forward to that. Our second guest this morning is Gemma Tarlek. She's the senior associate editor of Discover magazine. In their latest issue of the top 100 science stories of 2013, she'll be on the phone with us, and we're going to talk to her all about such stories as new signs of life on Mars, carbon dioxide hits 400 parts per million. Does it really matter? Scientists making progress growing organs from stem cells, and 97 more. Anyway, these stories plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
KPCW and the Park City Museum present the weekly series Park City History Bits. Learn a nugget of local history. A new bit debuts every week. Park City History Bits, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
Get a jump on the new year, no resolution needed, with the PC Marks Winter Workout Special.
Now through January 15th, receive 20% off our 1 and 3 month facility passes. Enjoy our indoor track, weights, cardio, gymnasium, and more. For more information, visit us online at parkcityrecreation.org or call 615-5400.
A jump on the new year, no resolution needed. PC Mark, a higher degree of play.
The Park City Mark is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio, making science and technology understandable, accessible, and hopefully entertaining. If we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, our first guest this morning, Gordon Burghardt, is actually a comparative psychologist at the University of Tennessee, but he's also an evolutionary biologist, a quite a decorated one at that. Now, he, along with his colleagues, have begun the study, or an ongoing study, of the reptilian brain. And as it turns out, lizards may be as intelligent as my co-host over there, John Wells.
Oh, my goodness.
And among other very interesting discoveries on different animals, mostly reptiles, I think, was what we'll speak about today, and how they evolve along with and maybe ahead of, we'll see, humans. So joining us by phone is Gordon Burghardt. And good morning to you, Professor.
Well, good morning to you, too.
So I do find this very interesting that, first of all, you're a psychologist, but you're an evolutionary biologist as well. So maybe you start off by explaining, you know, where your fascination lies and where your study lies with reptiles.
Well, I guess I've always loved reptiles, and particularly snakes. Those are my first love and still the animals that I work with the most. And my background is actually both in psychology and ethology, the study of animal behavior. And my area of concentration and expertise has always been reptiles. And so we've worked on behavior of baby reptiles all the way through adults, in turtles and snakes and lizards and even crocodilians. But lizards are the animals that right now we're seeing really good signs of really quick and rapid and complex learning, which people had not really expected for a long time.
So, yeah, all along we've looked at lizards as this little thing that darts around his head, you know, kind of jerking and reacting, really reacting rather than planning ahead. And not we haven't given them really any credit for being intelligent. So what were the past studies on lizards? What did they show?
Well, one of the problems in studying intelligence or learning or cognitive processes, whatever you want to call it, in animals is that you really have to know something about how they normally live. And so when psychologists started to look at lizards, for instance, they tried to test them the same way they would test rats. Well, rats are kept in a cool environment. The ideal temperature to test a rat would be 70 degrees. Well, at 70 degrees, most lizards, particularly those who live in the tropics, are very lethargic. They really need to be at about 90 degrees. And if you heat them up so that their metabolism really is operating in their brain metabolism, operating at optimal performance, they then do much better than if you test them at the same temperature you would test a rodent or a mammal at in general. So just things like that need to be taken into account. And when people are starting to do this, they're finding that lizards really are quite smart and can learn things quite rapidly, things that we didn't really expect that they were able to do, such as opening up a problem box or quickly reversing from being able to choose one object as correct to all of a sudden switching to a different one as being correct, given what rewards are associated with them.
So I find this a little disturbing, Professor Burghardt, that as scientists, we've known for, you know, a very long time, I'm not a scientist, but scientists have known, that reptiles are cold-blooded animals, right, or cold-blooded. But,
well, what that means is they're poikilothermic, as that's a technical term, or ectothermic, meaning that their temperature is based on the environment that they're in.
Okay. Okay, but they didn't know that lizards would actually be lethargic and not so smart at 70 degrees. That's really interesting to me that wouldn't have been something that would have been figured out a long time ago.
Well, actually, it was written about a long, long time ago, in the 70s, when people were starting to look at reptiles and learning, but most of the people studying it did not take that into those criticisms into account. But now we know a lot more about lizard metabolism and realize that they choose temperatures, and if you let them choose a temperature that they want to be at, rather than what the experimenter deems as important to them, then all of a sudden they perform a lot better.
Professor,
so they have to give the animal the choice. Where do they want to be? What temperature do they like?
Okay, that makes sense.
Professor Burghardt, a gentleman at the University of Sydney, Joshua Amiel, has 17 years of research on the effects of temperature on skinks. And so, speaking of temperature, and the research that he's provided is that the hotter the environment, the bigger, the faster the skink will be as it's being born. I guess the heat helps it to absorb more of the yolk, and also found that the skink had higher intelligence. And he made a statement that global warming may really be good for lizards.
I guess the jury's going to be out on that for a while, because many lizards, of course, do live in very warm environments already. And in fact, probably the largest and most dramatic lizard of all is the Komodo dragon, which lives on these islands off Indonesia, and it gets quite warm there. And we think they're one of the most intelligent lizards. But I guess there can be downsides to being too warm, too. And so I think we really need to be a little careful. But certainly within a group of animals, it could be that those that are warmer are smarter. But we really need to test that. For instance, there are species of lizards that live on mountains. And there are those that live near the top of the mountain where it's much cooler, and those that live down lower where it's warmer. And that would be a good group of animals to study to see if there's differences in the learning ability of the animals at different elevations where the temperatures vary.
Sure.
The same species in a natural setting.
Professor, let's talk about the about what you call intelligence, and that's the strategies that lizards are able to evolve to get a food source. Can you talk about the actual testing that you did?
Well, you can do a variety of different things. Now, one of the things that we have done is to provide small lizards with a problem to solve. And in this case, this was worked out with the Dallas Zoo and a former graduate student, in which we put mice into a little problem box that the animal could see, they could smell it, but they couldn't get access to it until they rotated it and opened the door to get access to it. And most lizards initially go for the visual cues. They respond to what they see rather than trying to deliberate, how can I actually get into the box? And what we found is that every one of the lizards we tested, all eight of them, solved the problem in just a few minutes. And the second time they were presented with it, they did it twice as fast. Now, there are other kinds of learning where you can have the animal discriminate, say, a box that's got a blue top versus a top, and how quickly they learn to only go to the one that has the food in it, which may be the blue or maybe the white. And then if you switch, the white one is now correct, not the blue one. If the animal switches very fast, that's a sign of what we call reversal learning or habit reversal. And that's considered a fairly high-level ability in animals. And we're now finding that a variety of different lizards have been tested in a variety of different labs, showing that they do have this ability to have reversal learning, which was thought beyond. It was only thought only some birds and mammals could do this.
Yeah. Okay, so this is very interesting, Gordon. I find that as humans, we're sort of up here on our high horse, aren't we, in terms of our own intelligence. We think, you know, we're the only animals that can emote, and we have this ability to adapt our behavior to our circumstances and our environment. But what we're finding is that, you know, a simple little lizard with a very small brain can also adapt his behavior, his or her behavior, I guess. And so, you know, what does this tell us really about evolution, I guess? And, you know, we know that the human brain also evolves in a variety of ways, but are lizards' brains really evolving?
Well, I would say that evolution is a process that is ongoing in all living matter. And how it plays out, how these changes and adaptations occur can vary, of course, quite widely. But we're finding out that insects and ants and starfish even and octopus and all kinds of animals can learn in different ways to respond to changes in their environment. And this is something that animals have had to do. Plants also. They have to adapt to changing environments. And so intelligence, as we sort of view it as a brain center kind of learning, is probably just a small piece of the larger picture of how animals adapt or change to their environments through their lifetimes or through evolutionary processes.
So the takeaway is that intelligence is widespread, and it's not necessarily limited to the animal world. I mean, we've known for a while that if you play a recording of a caterpillar eating leaves, excuse me, and you play that next to a plant, the plant will release chemicals in the leaves that will, in its own leaves, that'll repel the caterpillar, or, excuse me, that root systems see obstructions and reroute their roots and grow around rocks and all that kind of stuff. But recently, something just came out about a plant, the mimosas. Sounds like a champagne and orange juice. that they tested it, and the plant has memory. That it's able to retain memory for a month in different tests that they did. So, intelligence seems to be widespread.
Right, and here the issue is that if this is. This is a simple type of learning called habituation, and if this actually occurs in the plant and they do not have a brain or nervous system of any note at all, then that shows that you don't actually need a nervous system per se to adapt through some type of experience to your environment. And so the brain may just have evolved afterwards as a way of being more efficient in adapting to the environment, the mechanism to allow organisms to respond to cues in their environment more quickly, more efficiently. But the basic process may be much more ancient.
It's pretty fascinating, really. I mean, do you think scientists have overlooked these intelligences because we've counted so much on the fact that animals have things like a keen sense of smell and they're able to react to things like that in such an acute way?
Well, I guess that's certainly an important aspect of the picture. We need to understand what kind of stimuli animals respond to, just like and plants as well, and how well they do this and what senses they use to make the decisions or the cognitive processes that are involved in adapting to their world. So, yes, we do need to know much more about these senses. And one of the things that my career has been devoted to is the sense of smell or chemosensory behavior in snakes, because the snakes are really good at using their tongue to identify chemicals that are important for finding food, recognizing enemies, mates, and so on. And yet, we are not, as a species, very sensitive to odors like many other species are. And so we then overlook the fact that they may be using these senses to make complex decisions that we could never even imagine doing. And since we can't imagine it, we sometimes don't even study the process in these other species.
I see. Okay.
Professor, what question would you like to see answered that you've not answered yet?
Well, I guess when it comes to reptiles, there are so many because they have been neglected as a group by both behaviorists and psychologists for a long time, although that is changing now. There are recent studies on tool use, first discovery of tool use in crocodilians, in a reptile, in crocodilians. And so there are loads of things to be discovered out there. And I think probably the best thing we need is just people to go out and observe and study the natural history of these animals in their normal environments. And by seeing how they work, how they operate, how they perform in their natural habitats, we can get ideas as to what to test for in more controlled laboratory settings. But if you don't have that information, we often are not going to do the right kinds of observations in systematically. We're not going to ask the right questions. We won't even imagine the questions that we could ask. You talk about how humans like to think that they are sort of the top of the scale, and probably in some respects we are, but we've been dethroned in many ways. I remember a book called Man the Toolmaker that came out. Jane Goodall showed that chimps actually make tools, and now we're finding that many other animals make as well as use tools. So what we think is that sort of the human arrogance that we're the only ones who do this, we're the only ones who have a moral sense, we're the only ones who have emotions, we're the only ones who can remember the past. All those bromides are, I think, slowly disappearing. At least in the scientific community.
Uh-huh, right. So let's talk a little bit about the body-to-brain ratio. I mean, we know that the human brain is very large in our body-to-brain ratio. We know that the largest brain belongs to the sperm whale. They're very intelligent. The smallest brain is that of a green lizard. So does this blow, the theory out of the water that if you have a small brain to body, if you have a bad ratio, that way you're not going to be smart?
Well, I don't think we got to be careful here because there are other animals. Salamanders, for instance, have very small, probably even smaller brains than a lizard to the body size. So, and they are not, there's not many studies showing advanced cognitive processes in salamanders, although there are some that show that they can count, that they can recognize their mates for a long period of time and so on.
Uh-huh.
So we have to be very careful not to to underestimate or just use brain size as a mark of intelligence. we got to be careful here also, because there are some animals that have brain to body ratios equal or larger than ours, but they're small animals. Some birds, for instance, have very large brains for their body size. Fish that I studied, and there's very playful fish, has a brain to body ratio that's probably equivalent, if not larger, than that of a human. Sharks and rays, stingrays and so on, they actually have brains much larger than those of most other fish for the body size. So evolution has taken many really twists and turns, and we don't really know why some of these animals have the brain sizes that they have. And brain size in itself is not necessarily the best marker. Sometimes people want to look at brain density, the cell density within the brains, and how the connections, how many connections there are in the brains, rather than a gross measure of size itself.
And Professor, what I think is fascinating across many, many species of animals is the research that's being done that intelligence is distributed, and it's down at the cellular level, and that the communication and the ability of cells to be able to communicate with each other and to actually have intelligence. I mean, it's just fascinating. Hopefully there'll be more research in those areas.
Well, I think it's happening, but these days it's hard sometimes to get support for the kinds of studies that don't seem to have an immediate practical payoff, yet are really essential for understanding the larger pictures of how the animate universe, the living universe, operates and how it got to where it is.
It seems that an evolutionary biologist / psychologist has a pretty fun job.
Well, I certainly have enjoyed my career, and I've been able to do the kinds of things I've been wanting to do. Actually, my first paper, scientific paper, was in 1964 on lizards in a herpetology journal on lizard behavior, comparing two species, and I found that they responded somewhat differently based on their sensory abilities. And so I've been sort of continuing along this line for a long time, and worked on bears and many other species, and it's really sort of interesting. I think it's and fascinating to be able to do this kind of work, and so I feel it a privilege that I've been blessed with the opportunities to study these kinds of things. And my most recent work has been on play behavior, and I really think that I've been able to have a career where I can play with the ideas and the animals that I really love.
Yes. Oh, well, it's really great. And that, and you're a bit ahead of the wave here of research. So some might say that you have a brain that has a few more connections than the average brain. So, so very good for you. And Gordon Burghardt, again, a professor of psychology at the University of Tennessee. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, Gordon.
Oh, this has been a lot of fun.
All right. Take care.
Enjoyed it. Bye.
Bye. And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Now I'm curious about not only my brain, but your brain, John Wells. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages with Gemma Tarlek. She's the senior associate editor of Discover Magazine. She's going to talk about not the 100 top stories of 2013, but a couple of the top ones that we found really interesting. So stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Contrary to popular belief, getting pregnant can be difficult. For some couples, it can be quite a challenge. The OBGYNs at Park City Specialty Clinic are there to help you find solutions for pregnancy on your terms. The appointment number is 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization. 350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly starting at 5:30. Also serving Sunday brunch from 9 to 1. The website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Gemma Tarlak, and she's the senior associate editor of Discover magazine. Discover's just released their end-of-year issue with their 100 top science stories of 2013. New signs of life on Mars, CO2 levels hit 400 parts per million. Does it really matter? Science progress towards stem cells that grow complete organs, and, well, 97 others. We're not going to cover all 100. We're just going to talk about a few of them. But, Gemma, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah. Gemma, we don't know what historians will write about us, but the last 50 years have been a time of unprecedented scientific and technological discovery. And your magazine has... this particular issue has some new discoveries, but it also has very important updates, progress reports on items that have been discovered, well, over the last several years. So it's a very exciting time for us, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, our top story this year is kind of a continuation of one of our top 10 stories for 2012. And that was, of course, the Mars Curiosity rover. In 2012, we all remember that spectacular landing. I don't know about you, but I was sitting there biting my nails, waiting to see if it was going to happen. And this is the year, though, that Curiosity really started, earning its keep, so to speak. And it not only found an ancient stream bed on Mars, it was able to bore into the sediment and actually find signs of all the key ingredients for life: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen. And this is very exciting, and some additional data it collected is helping scientists understand how the situation may have changed from a planet where life was possible to sort of the rather dead place it is now.
And now it's on the move. I mean, it's just rolling along at, I don't know how fast, but over a year it's going to cover 5 miles, so it's not really moving that fast, is it?
No, it's kind of creeping, but hey, moving forward is always progress, right?
Moving forward, taking pictures, and I was also impressed with the sophistication of the instrumentation on the rover as it grabs samples and it synthesizes chemicals and it heats them up, it looks at them. It's just amazing.
It is. And, when you think about all the different elements, all the different specialties that came together to create this thing that is now on another planet doing the work of science, it's just mind-boggling.
Right. Gemma, I'm going to let you pick a story. And I would believe, I'm going to guess that it's a story that that Lynn and I are also fascinated by. But why don't you go ahead and pick one?
Pick one in terms of importance to science or a personal favorite?
A personal favorite.
Okay, well, that has got to be our 11th top story. And it's about the finding of the largest volcano on the planet. It's called Tamu Massif, and it's a good ways underwater, about a third of the way from Japan to Hawaii, in a formation called Shatsky Rise. And the reason I love this story, I was fortunate to have talked to the lead author of the study who found this volcano, Dr. Bill Sager, and this is the payoff for him of a 20-year hunch. He's been studying this underwater formation called Shatsky Rise for about 20 years, and he just had this hunch all along that this southern area of the formation was not only volcanic, but it was actually the largest single cone volcano. And he was finally able, technology kind of caught up with his hunch, and over the last few years, he's been able to use a lot of technology that they use in mining to actually bore into the sediment and bore into the volcanic rock figure out not only the depth but the size. And what he found was a 120,000 square mile volcano. That is bigger than the state of Arizona. The lava is up to 75 feet thick in places. And I want to make it clear before people get nervous that this volcano is extinct. Okay? We don't need to worry about it going off. It's about 145 million years ago that it last erupted. But the wonderful thing talking to him was not only being reminded that there are so many things on our planet we don't know about, but hearing in his voice this absolute jubilation that, you know, so many of our scientists spend their entire careers working in labs, working in the field, toiling away. And most of us don't really notice that much. But every now and then you get this find that people pick up on. There was a lot of media coverage of his find. And he had people on posting videos on YouTube writing songs about the volcano. And you could just hear him like, wow, you know, people are paying attention to something I've spent my life on. And that was just so rewarding to hear.
Yeah, and also very humble, as he says, he savors a sweet moment of 20 years in the making of all this research, working on this hunch. And as scientists, he says, we spend all our time doing research. But then you get that one moment when people look up from their smartphones and they're reminded of the wonder of the world.
Absolutely. I think that says so much, not only about him, but just about the importance of science that maybe we don't always appreciate day-to-day.
That's nice. You know, one sort of near and dear to my heart, I think because we've spoken about it on this show, Gemma, is the future of stem cell research, moving away from the controversy, really, and just coming into this explosion of the future for what we can grow from stem cells.
And, you know, absolutely. And in fact, there was so much going on in stem cell research that while we limited it to one number in our top 10, we put it at number 5. That actual number we split up into a bunch of small articles just to kind of give people a taste of this revolution. And the big deal is that basically now they are able to take a skin cell, one of your skin cells, any adult skin cell walking around, they get that cell, they reprogram it. Very detailed. I don't want to go into all the math and calculations behind it, but they reprogram it to be a stem cell, and then they can use that piece, technically, you know, of your own skin. They're able now to use it, for example, to grow something called a liver bud, and every time I hear that word, I imagine it on a menu in some super fancy restaurant. But what they're able to do now is grow liver buds from these skin cells that have been reprogrammed to be stem cells. They grow the liver buds, and they have their own blood vessels. And, you know, it's new research. I want to stress that. So it's not like tomorrow we won't need liver transplants anymore. But they are thinking 5 to 10 years down the road, they will be able to grow possibly replacement livers for people. And not only is that a huge boon for the thousands of people around the world who are in desperate need of a liver transplant, but the great thing is it's going to be your own skin cell. So you're not going to need the immunosuppressant drugs that people who have transplants have to take.
So for our listeners, let's just, you know, just take a quick step back. A human embryo is a fertilized egg. And in that embryo are stem cells that are remarkable because they make humans, but also because they divide and replicate forever. And also embryonic stem cells can morph into any cell type in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're talking about is that you can have someone's genetic material, say skin samples from me, for an example.
Mm-hmm.
And put into that unfertilized embryo and then trick it so that it starts dividing as if it was fertilized. So it's not fertilized, but it's tricked through this special science stuff.
You know, I hate to use the word tricked. Let's just say
reprogrammed
or persuaded or, you know, technically they do say reprogrammed. That's how they look at it.
It's been encouraged.
I like that.
And then you can remove the stem cells and cultivate them. And then they'll grow into tissues that can do various things, replace organs, heal injuries, and those sorts of things. And I think the takeaway is that the person's body that the genetic material was came from, it's their body, it's their cells, so there'll be less rejection from immune cells, and it'll be more personalized.
Right. And in fact, you know, the threat of rejection is a huge problem whenever anyone receives a transplant of a donor organ. And this eliminates that hurdle. I mean, it would be a fantastic thing, but I want to stress probably the experiments that are the furthest along are those liver buds, and we're still talking, you know, probably at least a decade out, assuming that no other obstacles crop up. But in addition to the liver buds, they were also able this year, a separate team was able to grow brain organoids. That's what they call them.
Wow.
I didn't pick the name.
Oh, I'd like a new brain, please.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing with I want to stress the brain organoids, they're not focused on thinking of coming up kind of with replacement brain tissue if, say, you suffer a trauma. They're looking at it more as using these brain organoids, which are also from skin cells that have been reprogrammed to be stem cells. They're looking at using them to research diseases of the brain, whether it be something like microcephaly, which is kind of a diminishment of the amount of brain tissue, or something like schizophrenia.
Mm.
So it's an exciting time for stem cell research.
That's really exciting. And, you know, just picking up on what you were saying about the immune response to a new organ, when you get a transplant, I have someone in my family who got a kidney transplant from his brother. But I didn't even realize this. I think most people don't, that for the rest of his life, he'll be on immunosuppressant drugs because so he won't kick out that kidney, even though it's so similar to what his own body would have, you know, produced.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it really alters his life pretty radically, even though he's, of course, happy to have a kidney that works. It's huge. It's very exciting.
Absolutely. And to think that they are, you know, years away rather than decades away from making this a reality is very exciting.
So, Gemma, a lot of people are kind of still under the impression that, you know, well, 18 years ago, they cloned Dolly the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone's thinking, oh, we're going to get the woolly mammoth in here. and we're not talking about that, Gemma. We're talking about extraordinary gains in helping to heal injuries, to replace organs, to maybe cure diseases. I mean, this is fascinating. And again, in this case, without fertilized eggs, with someone's actual genetic material inserted into the unfertilized embryo. It's just fascinating.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So why don't we do another? Or Lynn, go ahead. You have one?
Well, I'm wondering, this is so interesting, you have all this talk about stem cells and, you know, Voyager 1, you've got life on Mars, and then you have one of the science stories that seems more like psychology to me, and that is about childhood obesity. And it has to do with the world sort of coming along in their own psychology about opening up our brains and our minds and having a new look at health, I guess.
Well, with the childhood obesity story, actually that was looking really at statistics between 2008 and 2011, where they looked at about 12 million children in 40 states, two territories, and the District of Columbia. And for the first time in years, in 18 of the states, obesity rates declined. Three states showed no increases, and the remaining, three states showed increases, and the remaining 19 showed no difference. And that sounds like a very small change, you know, just, but let's face it, the obesity epidemic is so disturbing and needs to be addressed that even a small positive change is encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. So, John, you were going to talk about something else.
Oh, well, I wanted to jump ahead a little bit, if we could, and take a look at number 25.
And, I knew you were going to ask me about quantum computing.
I'm kind of a silicon freak, and
no.
I'm also kind of an interested party in quantum computing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can tell us about that. It's well, I'm going to let you go ahead with it.
Okay. Now, I am going to admit something. I love volcanoes. I love dinosaurs. I love fossils. Quantum computing took me a while to wrap my head around. So I'm going to explain it to you the way I learned to explain it to myself that makes sense. And basically, if you think about the computers we use today, they use binary. They reduce everything into data that is either a zero or a one. And that's it. There is no option to be like a 0.5 or to be 0 and 1 at the same time. They reduce everything to strings of data that is a 0 or a 1.
Right.
With quantum computing, what they're looking at is the possibility of creating a processor that is capable of looking at data that is a 0 or a 1, or simultaneously both, or simultaneously neither. And that's really kind of the basic gist of what quantum computing is. And, you know, we had a couple stories actually this year in our Year in Science issue on quantum computing, because it's a complicated field. It's a very hot field right now. And there were a few different advances made. But the question I get a lot from readers, from folks when they hear I work at Discover is, well, when can I get one? When can I get a quantum computer?
Yeah.
You know, and I just want to stress that kind of the easiest way to think about quantum computing is you probably have a car, and you use that car to get to work, to get your groceries, to pick your kids up from the school. And you know what? That car is okay for you. You don't really need a supersonic jet plane, right? Because if you're just driving to the grocery store, your car is fine. You're not going to take a plane. And that's kind of what I want to say to people who expect to have a quantum computer. When they actually have quantum computers out there, there is one company in Canada called D-Wave Systems that is selling what they're calling a quantum computer, but there's some disagreement over whether it is. And they've actually sold them to NASA and Google, so the big players in this are definitely interested. But when quantum computing becomes a thing and it's out of the lab and into actual use, it is really only going to be useful to people like NASA and mm-hmm. Jet Propulsion Labs, because all it is really doing is capable of processing data magnitudes faster than we are now. So is it going to make it easier to stream that Netflix video for you? No. Is it going to make it easier for scientists to crunch billions of data points about, say, exoplanets outside our solar system? Yes. So people get all excited about quantum computing and think it's going to allow them to travel back through time and what have you. But right now, we need to just take a deep breath and realize that it does not have any consumer applications. It's once it becomes practical to use, it's only going to be practical to use by researchers who are involved in crunching incredible amounts of data.
Well, it's going to take a lot of time, and quantum physics is just absolutely bizarre. The more we learn about it, it seems we go to a higher level of confusion with more questions. But I just want to throw one thing on the table, and that's that they have this thing called entanglement, and
mm-hmm.
that's when you can teleport information instantly over infinite amounts of space. And I guess they've been able to do this on a single chip, and they've also been able to do it over several hundred miles. But the implications for that in the future, when I think about fault-tolerant computers and those sorts of things, if you have a computer that's or a bank of computers that's chugging away in New York City to
mm-hmm.
instantaneously be able to provide that same information over to a remote site hundreds of miles away, so you don't have to worry about replication – is so important in computers. So I think there's applications for that as well.
I think so as well. But again, you know, in terms of in the next 5 years, making it easier to, you know, upload a photo of your cat to Facebook. No, it's no.
You know, that word quantum in and of itself is so, it's almost kind of woo-woo, you know, that we hear of quantum physics and quantum theory and quantum mechanics sometimes it seems almost as though people debunk the whole theory, which is impossible. But I think it's something that's sort of out there, this thing that is almost intangible.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of our other top 10 stories was about the discovery of something called the amplituhedron. And it's interesting that you say, you know, quantum physics and the whole idea of a lot of the stuff going on now in physics is intangible. I think number 10, the discovery of the amplituhedron, is a great example, because there's a professor, Nima Arkady-Hamed, in Princeton, who figured out a new geometric shape called the amplituhedron that is actually allowing physicists an easier way of making their calculations and sort of projecting their theories into how it might actually work. It's, again, it's very esoteric, but the most interesting thing to me about this story was it showed that even the guys deeply immersed in this very esoteric field, even they have trouble, you know, explaining and calculating and delving into the complexities of their own theories. So now it's a little bit easier now that they have the amplituhedron, but I love that story because it shows that, yeah, even they need help trying to figuring it out.
Oh, that's all very exciting. And from what we find on this show is that other modes of science, other types of science, if you integrate anything like the last person we just talked to was an evolutionary biologist, but, you know, he paired psychology with, you know, with science, with hard science, and came up with a further discovery. So when you talk about needing help, maybe it comes from other parts of science that it's starting really to happen. This, you know, they're coalescing their knowledge from different areas.
Yeah, we've actually done.
The great thing about science is it's always starting to happen. You know, it's always progress and it's always advancing.
Right.
And we've done a number of shows where a common theme has been collaboration among disciplines that never really worked together before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's just fascinating. I just want to mention something for our listeners, just sort of layperson talk. When we talk about quantum and what that means, first of all, there's a huge body of work. It's over 75 years old. It started with Einstein. It's called general relativity, and that's basically the very large and the very far apart star systems, galaxies, those sorts of things. Quantum is the very small and very close together, and that's a completely different discipline. And then to sort of reconcile those two completely different disciplines to make sense of it all, something called string theory, which we haven't talked about yet today. But for our listeners at home, quantum is very exciting, and we're learning more every day.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the hottest fields now in science, and also a field that I expect to be writing a lot about at the end of 2014.
Yeah, exactly. Gemma, what one question would you like to see answered in the next year of all these different things going on?
Wow. What one question would I personally like to see? Well, I'm really excited about advances they're making in the ability to sequence ancient DNA. You know, one of our top 10 stories talked about the successful sequencing of a 700,000-year-old horse, successfully sequencing its DNA. But just since we've published that story, they were able to sequence the DNA of a 400,000-year-old early human or early hominid. And that's exciting to me because, you know, there is so much discussion, so much contention about the chart of evolution, where we came from, if we are, you know, related to certain early hominids, what's our relationship to Neanderthals, what's our relationship to another group called the Denisovans, and just that we are able to use some new techniques to start really getting into this DNA that's 400,000 years old and really understanding and absolutely having that proof that, yes, we can say this is our tree of life. That is really exciting to me. And I think we're going to hear some great developments in the next year.
Jen, I wish you were more enthusiastic. You need to come out of your shell.
I know. My life is hard. My job is terrible.
I tell you what, you got a great job.
Absolutely.
I do. Absolutely.
We love Discovery Magazine here. Lynn and I look at it all the time, and we see your name, and we see, you know, see the things that you're covering. It's pretty cool.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely.
You know, that leads me to maybe my last question here as we're running out of time, Gemma, how is the magazine doing overall, and how much is your online presence? I mean, I know there are a lot of magazines that we referred to that only have an online presence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's it going? You're such a well-established magazine. How's it going for you, and how's it looking with the online versus the hard copies?
Well, you know, it's interesting that we're doing well in both areas. We have our very loyal print subscribers who come back year after year, and I think our print version is doing so well Because they're finding things that they don't generally find online. You know, online now, not with the Discover site, but just in general, you're always seeing those lists, you know, top 10 photos of celebrities in sweatpants or whatever. And there isn't that really rich, deep narrative journalism that you'll find in a print magazine like Discover. Mm-hmm. And our online, our website is doing well. And we have bloggers. We started long-form journalism where we'll take, say, most of our features, for example, are 2,000 to 4,000 words. We started online-only long-form features that are 15,000 words, where readers who are interested in a topic, interested in the scientists we cover, can really delve deep into the science, into the research, and into the discoveries. So it's exciting, I think. I look at it as sort of different tentacles of the same giant squid. And I should say, I love giant squid.
And I believe that. That's great. 15,000 words cost the same as 2,000 words, so why not put more online? I like that. I like that. Well, I just want to end by telling you that, you know, you ought to come here to Utah because you said you like dinosaurs. And
I have been to Utah for your dinosaurs. They are excellent.
Oh, very good. We talk to every paleontologist around these parts, and it's so much fun. It seems like we've got a paleontologist with a new dinosaur discovery on about every other week. It's
yeah,
fun.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And visit us at Cool Science Radio. We're right here in Park City.
I would love to.
And we're directly above a liquor store. It's really cool. So
I don't know why you think I would care about such a thing.
Well,
but,
you know,
okay.
I don't know. I'm just taking a shot there, Gemma. But okay. We are speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor of Discover Magazine, and we will invite you back to Cool Science Radio. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, okay. Gemma.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to do a pretty quick Cool Science Story of the Day.
Jan, I just don't know what to do.
Don, you're such a flake.
If only there were a show on Friday at 9 a.m. to fill me in on Frosty Weekend Fun.
I thought you knew. Warm up your weekend with Fun Friday.
Find out what to do, who to see, and where to go.
Don't be left out in the cold.
Tune in to Fun Friday for frostbite-free fun. Thanks to our jingly sponsors.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
Foothill Oriental Rugs.
Wasatch Pub, Squatter's Pub and Brewery.
And Summit County Business Directory. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with John Wells. Well, in today's cool story, how about this? The 223rd meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Washington, D.C. The longest exposure image taken with NASA's Hubble Space Telescope is the deepest ever picture taken of a cluster of galaxies. And it also contains images of some of the intrinsically faintest and youngest galaxies, ever detected. The target now is the massive cluster Abel 2744, which contains several hundred galaxies as they looked 3.5 billion years ago.
Now, how does the Hubble do this? Well, imagine holding a single grain of sand at arm's length and capturing the light for 2 weeks. And that's how far away Hubble was looking, and that's how faint the light was. And we talked about collaboration. They got some help. Simultaneous observations are done with NASA's two other great observatories, the Spitzer Space Telescope and the Chandra X-ray Observatory. But anyway, if you Google Hubble Deep Field Studies, you'll be able to take a peek at this most extraordinary picture. And if you have any trouble getting that, please get a hold of us in KPCW here, and we'll get that picture to you.
That's pretty fascinating. A grain of sand at arm's length and capturing that light for 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you for that metaphor there, that analogy, because we just don't realize. Well, we want to thank our guests today, Gordon Burghardt and Gemma Tarlak, of course, from Discovery. Magazine or Discover Magazine. Also, thanks to San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, and Peak Art and Frame for underwriting this program. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Tune into Fun Friday tomorrow at 9 a.m.